All right, play your Christmas jingle. Did you do one?
I did.
So excited.
I'm actually really looking forward to this.
It would be so funny if I just it was just the regular one, but it starts off with like ho 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 and it goes right into the regular one again.
Oh my god.
Alright, here we go.
I knew there'd be bells. And welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show for the insatiably curious, hosted by your favourite scientists and science communicators, where we talk about anything and everything. Today, as always, we will be diving into a big science topic, we will be answering a question, and we will be taking a look at a miscellaneous topic. My name is Ella, and I'll be covering today's science topic, and we are going to be talking about chimeras.
Ooh.
The most festive topic you could there could ever be. Santa's a chimera, right?
I believe. Santa is very famously half man, half goat.
Whoa.
Wait. This is gonna be a science topic.
Yeah.
I'm so curious now. Oh boy!
It's always a science topic.
No, okay. But we could approach chimeras from like a miscellaneous topic as well. I'm very curious. Yeah.
Oh no, this is a science topic.
I didn't forget the format of the podcast.
And it sounded like you did.
My name's Caroline, and this week's question is: what are Judas goats?
I know this. I don't know it. I almost know it.
Well, you say both and then we'll edit in which one is correct and we'll edit out the other one. I know it. I don't know it. I kind of know it.
I'll explain why I said both I know it and I don't know it when we get to the question.
If it helps, I have no idea. I'm very curious to hear the answer to this because I truly do not know. My name is Tom and today's miscellaneous topic is about the most important part of the holiday season, the thing that unites all cultures across time and space.
Jesus.
Toys.
Oh.
I was going to say capitalism, but cool.
Some of the oldest toys we know of, as well as our favorites. And this was another topic that started off as something I thought would be really simple, but I ended up in quite a wormhole, so we'll get into it.
This is
but,
exciting.
You always do, and I'm so excited.
Tom, you thought that this could be a miscellaneous topic because we have been using the term chimera for thousands of years. In Greek mythology is when the term arose. A chimera is a fire-breathing monster, which is part lion, part goat, and part serpent. So it has a lion's head, a goat's middle with a goat's head in the middle, and a serpent's tail with also a serpent's head. I don't know. Also, it's female.
I didn't know that. Is that really a stipulation for it?
Yeah, I couldn't find it. It always states that it's female. I don't know why.
I would love to know why. That's so bizarre.
Yeah, there's probably some secret sexism there we can uncover if we dug hard enough. But
it also doesn't make sense because they put the lion's head as a male lion's head.
Oh,
if you're gonna say something, at least be scientifically accurate.
I agree. Of course, throughout...
That's the only scientifically inaccurate part of the chimera. That's where I draw the line.
This is where I draw the line.
Wait a second.
Goat head in the middle of its body? Fine. Male lion head? No, too far.
So is this not what we're going to be talking about?
No, it's not what we're talking about. I mean, there are lots of chimeras in Greek mythology. Minotaurs and mermaids and centaurs.
Wow, there were a lot, huh?
Yeah, so... In architecture, a chimera or...
Oh.
Yeah, I know. In architecture, a chimera or chimera, it's a French term, is a term loosely used for any grotesque, fantastic, or imaginary beast used in decoration.
Ooh, okay.
So
your mom could be a chimera.
Fuck's sake.
Wow. Comedy.
Is this where we kick Tom out?
You don't deserve to be here anymore. It's not 2010, Tom. So basically, monsters and grotesque things is what chimeras have been throughout most of history. But this is also an actual scientific term that we use in research. So we're off to a good start with its background, right? If you Google the image for a human chimera, you get a lot of imagery, like grotesque human animal hybrid imagery like this when you like look for chimeras or what chimeras are about on the internet. All that a chimera means in science is a single organism that's composed of cells that are genetically distinct from one another. Okay? That's it. That's all a chimera is. So genetically distinct as in carrying a different genome, a different set of DNA. So flowers are very commonly chimeras. You get like bicolor flowers that people have constructed. So it's like two different like species of flowers that are basically fused together.
So can I ask, does that mean like my because like there are lots of different kinds of cells in the human body, right, that are differentiated. Could you say that definition one more time?
Oh, that's really interesting. All of your cells in your body contain the same genes. It's just that some of them are on and some of them are off, and that's what makes them differentiated. So they're not genetically different from one another. They express different cells.
Oh.
So if my cells were in you for some reason, then that would make you chimera'd. So, for example, you could argue that someone who's had a bone marrow transplant is a chimera, because the blood cells...
Interesting.
But that makes a lot less of a shocking image on Google Images.
Yeah, exactly.
The person just smiling, just being like,
hey, it's me, I've got blood now. Because the blood cells that propagate from the bone marrow will be genetically distinct from their cells.
Oh, wow.
There's also something called...
Oh, Caroline has to step away for a second.
This is great, because I got a great joke lined up that I can now say.
Oh, God.
We should be okay now.
Cool. It's a lot less exciting to be like, I have a bone transplant from Joe, so I'm a Tom Joe chimera. It's not quite as entertaining.
Do you want me to laugh?
There we go.
I'm going to edit the biggest laugh in there.
To be fair, it actually is a good joke, but the fact that you told me you were going to do it made me feel like I have to not laugh.
Wait.
Carolyn, when you stepped away, I told Ella, I was like, oh, this is great, because I have a great joke.
I'm
going to
do my joke now. Oh, dear. Okay. There is also something called fetal maternal microchimerism. Is basically a very small number of cells transferred from the fetus to the mother during pregnancy and vice versa.
Oh!
So fetal cells have been found in the mothers up to 3 decades after pregnancy.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's insane.
I know, right? Cells from the fetus are called pregnancy-associated progenitor cells, and they can become many different types of cell. They've been found in many organs and in the blood, and they are thought to be associated with some beneficial effects, like an increased rate of tissue repair and wound healing. But researchers also report that this microchimerism is associated with an increased risk of developing autoimmune diseases and inflammatory skin disorders after pregnancy. And this risk may depend on how closely the mother and baby are immunologically matched.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting. And none of this is what I'm talking about today.
Oh. Is it back to mythology?
Circling back round.
Psych! Double psych!
I mean, this is all well and good, but anyone who knows anything about chimeras, they want the juicy stuff. And this is your man-made human-animal hybrids. Your pig-sheep dog men. No, it's not like those images, right? It's not that dramatic. Because scientists, particularly scientists working with animals, they rarely do something just for the sake of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
For many reasons. And so chimeras, human-animal hybrids, human chimeras, they have to serve a purpose. So in the US, over 100,000 people are on the waiting list for an organ. And chimeras could provide an unlimited amount of human organs and tissues.
Wow.
And we can talk about the moral and ethical issues surrounding this afterwards. But for now, let's look at the science of growing human organs in animals. I want to start by talking about the work of Japanese biologists Hiromitsu Nakauchi and Toshihiro Kobayashi, who really pioneered chimera. They really pioneered chimera methodology. And this is a paper from 2010, published in Cell, and it's titled "Generation of Rat Pancreas in Mouse by Interspecies Blastocyst Injection of Pluripotent Stem Cells." I know that's very clear.
Fine. Just a real light read before bed, you know?
So basically, in this paper, they describe growing a pancreas made entirely from mouse cells in a rat and vice versa. And that's the only thing in the mouse or rat that came from the other species.
Wow.
And obviously it might not sound as impressive if you're waiting for these human-pig hybrids, but it is incredibly impressive. The science behind it is exquisite. And to me, it feels like science fiction, like, come to life. It's like the methodology of this paper is absolutely beautiful. I'm going to try and describe some of it to you. So an animal with the cells, or whole organ in this case, of another species of animal is called an interspecies chimera, just for some context. So that's what I'll refer to. And the technique they use to generate interspecies chimeras here is called blastocyst complementation. Do you know what a blastocyst is?
It's in there somewhere.
I do know complementation is what I need to feel any joy in my life from other people. That's all. No, neither of those words, yeah.
I feel like I mentioned it in the pregnancy test video.
Yeah, I think
pregnancy
you did.
Test episode,
I think you did.
But it's gone out of my head again, yeah.
It's basically an early stage embryo. It's at the stage where there are no differentiated cells yet, but it's a hollow ball.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, listening, undifferentiated means unspecialized. Differentiated means specialized, and I'll use that term as we go on. So how blastocyst complementation works, and I'll use the context of the paper to explain it. So you've got a rat blastocyst, this hollow ball of cells, which is missing a gene called PDX1. They've deleted this gene, and this gene is necessary for the development of the pancreas. So you take the healthy mouse stem cells, pluripotent stem cells, and pluripotent here means it can become any cell type, almost any cell type. You inject the healthy mouse pluripotent stem cells, or PSCs, into the rat blastocyst. And as the embryo grows, the mouse cells, which still have that PDX1 gene expression, will fill the empty developmental niche and grow into the pancreas.
Oh, wow!
They don't seem to go anywhere else. They just grow into a pancreas. You implant the blastocyst into the host female rat. Yeah, they'll give birth to this healthy rat pup, which grows up fine. It produces its own insulin from pancreas. It just happens that this pancreas is entirely derived from a mouse instead of from a rat.
Wow.
That's mad.
It is. It's incredible. It's amazing proof of concept. So amazing that it can just be done at all.
Yeah, because surely, like, rejection of the organ.
Right, yeah, that's sort of my full understanding about some of this stuff, right? Is that...
Yes, for whatever reason, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I guess because it's so, I guess, early on. I don't know. I'm just throwing out.
I think that is probably exactly it. The thing is, this is much, much harder to do with humans. And one of the main issues here is evolutionary distance. Mice and rats are incredibly evolutionary and genetically similar versus, like, a pig and a human. Also organ, like the organ choice. So the choice of the pancreas in this paper was likely very deliberate, because you can prevent it from developing, at least in rodents, by just deleting this single gene, PDX1.
Yeah.
You can't do this in other species and with other organs. Sometimes you can, but a lot of the time you can't. But with those kind of difficulties, I will tell you briefly about what has been attempted with human cells. So onto our human-animal hybrids. And this has all been done with blastocyst complementation, like was done in that paper, because that really set it up. Also, when researchers do this with human cells, they will normally inject something called iPSCs instead of PSCs. And these are induced pluripotent stem cells. This technology is also mind-blowingly amazing, because for the longest time we thought that once a cell had differentiated, it could not change. But actually, it turns out if you throw some very specific chemical factors at those cells, we can reverse them back into stem cells.
Wow.
What?
I did not know we could do that. That's insane.
Maybe one day I'll do like an in-depth stem cell. Like science topic, because it's what I studied. It's part of my degree and what I do now. And I love them, obviously. But the benefit of using induced pluripotent stem cells is that we could, if Caroline, if you needed a liver, we could take a skin cell from you, turn that back into a stem cell, and plant that into an animal which was missing the liver niche. It would grow into your own liver.
Whoa.
It would grow at the site to the size of a pig's liver, but it would be your liver.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. So that prevents graft rejection, so you don't need to use immunosuppressive drugs after transplant, which is one of the biggest issues people have with transplants. Now, as far as I'm aware, all of the examples I'm going to talk about now, they don't have the gene deletion. So they're just, at this stage, proof of concept to see if human cells can incorporate at all into an animal embryo. So one of the first examples I found is the injection of human iPSCs into a mouse blastocyst. So trying to put human cells into mice. This was in 2013, and the mice were sacrificed at a really early stage of development, so they don't even know how much human tissue would have grown. It did incorporate, though, in some way. That one, that's not that interesting. But then we get up into 2017, and they put human...
These are so recent also.
Really new research, and we'll get really close to current day as well. So they did human embryonic stem cells this time. So stem cells from an embryo into pig and cow embryos. For the pigs, these were grown in a sow, an adult pig, for 3 to 4 weeks.
And so just to be like crystal clear, they're not like fusing human and pig embryos together, right? They're just like grafting some human cells onto the pig blastocyst.
Exactly. And I found an article talking about the ethical issues of growing human organs in animals, and obviously there are certainly a lot of ethical issues to consider, but this article said that the fetal pigs had begun to partly grow human organs, which is just like abjectly not true. The way this stuff is reported is so ridiculous sometimes. The human cells engrafted and integrated into the embryo, but they did so in like insanely low numbers, especially compared to like a rat mouse chimera. Yun Wu, who was the lead researcher in this paper, even said there's just a quote of him saying it was very disappointing.
Oh wow.
I love that. I love that. I with the the way that articles love to, that's the real science most of the time, right? Is that sometimes things are disappointing, and it's that's just, how it is.
Outcome was disappointing.
And so this same group of scientists who did these pig and cow chimeras also did the first human monkey chimeras. The first news of this came out in 2019, but the paper was published this year in April. So they did, again, human embryonic stem cells into macaque embryos. They didn't implant the embryos into a monkey, into a female monkey. They grew them in vitro, which means out of body. And the maximum time any of the embryos survived was 19 days. They weren't able to control which cells developed into which tissues, which is a really key step before you can actually use these. But they still consider this like a huge step in showing that it could be done.
So, sorry, just to like contextualize, Ella, because I feel like with and I think, you know, this is sort of your point, but like with a lot of these crazy headlines that we've probably seen with these like fake images that are not. Most of the time they're like an artist made something and someone's just like pulling it in because it's like a shocking image. But like most of the time these are, I'm just trying to recontextualize it. Like these images, it's probably just like people using pipettes and like little dishes with like cells.
Yeah,
in them,
it's
right?
Like, it's like embryos in a dish, right? It's not even, a lot of the time it's not even implanting them. And if they do implant them, they have to like sacrifice them early because of ethical reasons, so they don't ever let it get to a stage where that could be like a viable like animal. It's basically,
but that's good to know, because I feel like you definitely have a lot more context into like the real how this actually looks, but like as someone having seen, you know, like a lot of shocking images on clickbait websites, it's important to like take a step back and realize like it's just right now it's just cells.
No, exactly. Cells. And I think people they might think that there's like a very famous image of that mouse with the human ear grown on its back.
Yeah.
And that is real, but that's because it's just a structure they grew. Like it's not it's not you know, it's just an external
functional.
Yeah, it's not functional in any way. It doesn't have a you know, so
it's not like an eardrum actually.
Yeah, it's not. It's just, not a real ear. It's just the shape of an ear, right? And so, like realistically, what we can actually do is so it's really in the very early stages, and that doesn't mean it's not amazing that they've done this. But it's just, you know, this is the what it's actually like. Obviously the benefit of using non-human primates here is that they are evolutionary much closer to humans, but macaques are like not even our closest relatives. That's chimpanzees and bonobos, and we're even them, we are still more evolutionary distant to them than rats are to mice. So this is like,
yeah,
it is a really difficult thing to do, and as you can imagine, very controversial.
Yes, very, very, very controversial.
I would say this particular study has been more controversial than any of the other ones that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Because non-human primates are much more protected in law in most countries more than other animals. And researchers argue that there is no need to use them because we ultimately can't use them for growing organs. Cows and pigs would be much more suitable here because they'll be human-sized or close enough. I found one researcher in an article from Nature who seems to very vocally disagree with this research in the monkeys for the reasons I just mentioned. His name is Alfonso Martinez Arias. He's a developmental biologist at Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona. And there's a really great quote from him in the Nature article talking about the research. So this is from the article. It says, "Martinez Arias was not convinced by the results. I expect better evidence." That's it.
Oh, wow.
Mic drop.
That's beautiful. Wow.
I think he goes on to expand on it, but like that, they just do that. I expect better evidence, and then they move on for a bit. It's like, what?
Damn.
It's like, damn, that's fucking... In science, between researchers, that's big fucking talk.
Like, yeah. They are starting beef right there. Oh my goodness.
That beef is statistically significant.
So if we want to talk about ethical issues, I will say that one particular ethical issue that's always mentioned when it comes to any human-animal chimera is the incorporation of human cells into parts of the animals that where we don't want them to go. So, for example, gametes, eggs and sperm, is one concern in case you get like scary human-animal hybrid babies. I think that one's less realistic because even if you get those gametes...
Like for them to then breed with a pig...
Yes, for that to like
those
become
cells are
a thing.
Not compatible with each other.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the larger concern, this is always brought up, is the idea of too many human cells being incorporated into the brain during development. So could the animal develop a human-like consciousness, and what rights would it then have?
Oh, well, that's terrifying. Yeah.
It is. I think it's a really interesting point, but it's. I think it's also very telling that this is such an anthropocentristic approach. You know, the animal is only considered when it becomes more human-like.
Yeah.
That is a really good point.
Because, like, when I'm thinking about, like, oh, if we did this in pigs, I'm very much just like, oh, yeah, it's basically like farming at that point. And then as soon as it's like, oh, you're making it very human, though, then... my opinion very quickly changes.
Well, exactly.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I wanted to end this whole section by asking you guys what your ethical stance would be on this. Organ farming, and it would probably, if this ever happened, it would probably be in like a domesticated animal like a pig or a cow.
It's I will say it's really tough because I feel like we especially us grew up during an era, I think, like post Dolly the sheep in where you know, beginnings of stem cell research, where there is a lot of media bias against this. Some of it is completely, you know, like unfounded in terms of there's a lot of fear from just misreadings and misinterpretations of things. but it's very like rooted in me. Like throughout all of this, part of me is just sort of like, ooh, ooh. But thinking about I will ask, you know, sort of the positives of this obviously are just that it would save a lot of lives, right?
A lot of lives. Yeah. Yeah.
I also, the animals that would be used to like farm organs would be treated better than animals are in livestock. I'm just,
yeah.
I don't think this is.
You know what?
I'm just saying.
Great point. Very good point. No. Very good point. And that is what's been very interesting about this is like, I feel like at the very beginning, like I think in introspecting my squeamishness, I am uncovering a lot of like biases that I have and assumptions and the idea of that is a fantastic point. I hadn't even considered that they would be treated better than livestock.
Yeah.
Good grief.
What were you gonna say, Caroline?
For me, it feels I love this in theory, and I think that it's something that in the future we should do, because you know, like separating this from farming is very difficult for me. I think they're very, very close. But like the amount of waste, particularly like if we have a pig and we're growing, say it's pancreas, you then can't use the rest of the pig, because in theory you could be eating human.
Yes, absolutely. It would not be eaten. There's absolutely no chance.
It just would not happen. And then that leads to a lot of wasted animals, which is something that I have a bit more of an
issue with. I agree with you to an extent. I will say,
yeah,
the number of people requiring organ transplantations that would be able to get this done,
yeah,
would not even approach the amount of waste in farming.
Right.
Okay, that's fair.
And
yeah,
because 100,000 people say getting it done, you know, that's nothing comparatively.
Yeah.
And also in research, the amount of waste animal like is insanely overwhelming.
Yeah.
Anyway, so like,
yeah.
I do actually agree with you, and I think the waste should be reduced in research with animals, but
yeah, but actually maybe there are other areas that should be focused on first rather than this. But yeah,
another interesting point I just realized from y'all discussing that is that like I feel like the notion of this, the popular notion is that like these are like scientists going like too far. It's like, what if we did this and this for this reason, when in reality it's like, no, I want to make a liver to save a human life.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's, this isn't mad science creativity, just like what ifs. These are very direct problems that we have with modern medicine that these solutions are trying to directly address, as opposed to being like, you know, like, yeah, people going like, oh, what if we did this? It's like, no, there's a very practical, real problem that these are trying to address, which I think doesn't get the same headline, right?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with both you and both the points you've made. I will say my stance is like I'm very much of two minds about it, because
and
I guess I have more, my opinion is actually shaped by an extra bit of information I have, which I will, I guess I can tell you now, that we have, so I eat meat, so it would be very hypocritical of me to think that this was, like, farming for organs was bad compared to farming for meat, although there's an element of squeamishness in it that, like, overrides your kind of, like, set, like, your common sense or your rationality, but ultimately, I'm not against it for that reason. But especially in research, I think it's incredibly important that we, like, a lot of animals do go into research, like a lot, and I don't think it's right to the extent that it happens. And one of the things that we, like, scientists are trying to do, particularly, like, stem cell researchers, regenerative medicine researchers, is using, developing technologies that don't use animals. So there's this thing called, there are these things called organoids, which are like mini organs in a dish that people are using to like simulate organ environments in humans. They're still pretty rudimentary, but people can grow like whole brain structures in a dish, right? You can grow beating like mini beating hearts.
Boy, howdy. I want the listeners to know the big smile on Ella's face as she's listing all these.
And this is also, I have not done any research for this bit. I'm just coming in with information that I know because I like this.
Yeah.
there's this like this idea of you can do like biological 3D printing. You can put like cells into like a 3D printing. This is super early days as well. So you could like the idea is you could print the scaffold of an organ and then use like organoid technology to seed cells onto it and grow it into a full organ. This is also really early. I would say it's even earlier than that animal hybrid, the chimera stuff, right? But I think more money should be put into this, personally.
Because it
doesn't just solve the issue of organs, it solves a lot of other kinds of issues too with animal research.
That would be amazing.
One of the things I learned from cognitive science, like the paradox of animal research is that in order for it to be relevant to humans, the animal has to be similar, you know, genetically to humans for it to be relevant. But then conversely, it has to be dissimilar enough from a human for it to not be morally wrong to experiment. Yeah. And so you have this push-pull of like, the more relevant it is, the worse, the more relevant to humans the research is, the more morally dubious it is. And then you can't get both, right?
Yeah. I think one day I'll talk about animal models because I find them really, really fascinating. Like the kinds of things although you say there is a good point to what you're saying, but the idea of it having to be very similar to us to be relevant isn't always the case. Like the amount of information we've found from fruit flies is insane.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Yeah.
From zebrafish, from something called C. elegans, which is a nematode worm. We have this crazy background of understanding human biology through these animals. I'll probably talk about that one day, but you also have a good point, particularly in the case of chimeras. It really does have to be very similar to us, and that is very emotionally invoking, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's really interesting because you have to dig past your gut reactions. You have to dig past the sort of popular media notion, and you have to take a look at both the science of it and also your own assumptions and beliefs and understanding. This is also great because this is a perfect Christmas dinner moral discussion you can have with your family.
Oh,
you just want to like throw that in there and be like, hey, how y'all feel about chimeras?
It's so interesting bringing this information to you to maybe more so Tom as like something that you've never heard of in really outside of mythological context or whatever.
Right.
Because I've never had a particularly strong moral quandary with this because I learned about it from the very basics. You start with what is a stem cell and you build up to what is a blastocyst. Yeah. Like every small step was built up on until it eventually became what is a chimera. And I understood all the science going into it. It was just a puzzle pieces that came together. So it never felt I had to pull myself back and look at the bigger picture to think of it more ethically and morally, which is what I've eventually my conclusions weren't. They didn't come naturally. Like I wasn't thinking in that way at first.
No, it's totally interesting. Yeah, from a down up perspective, it is very. It's just cells growing, right?
Yeah.
But then from an up down perspective, where it's like chimeras, and it's
I agree. I totally agree.
So I'm also doing another slightly controversial topic this week. So it's a good one.
A wonderfully controversial Christmas.
Love this. Yeah, everybody has all the juicy stuff to take to their family Christmas meals. It's going to be great. So my question this time is, what is a Judas goat and how are they used in conservation?
Oh!
So we'll do the first part first. I think Ella knows what a Judas goat might be.
So basically, Caroline did a TikTok about this and told us not to watch it.
I didn't really.
I came across it and then it started playing and you say what it is in like the first 5 seconds, and then I like panicked. I panicked.
See, Ella.
No.
Ella, I'm a much better friend in that I never watch Carolyn's video. Yeah. I respect their opinion, so I never.
I paused it, and then I went into your comment section, and it's people just absolutely firing off fighting. Like,
it got people very angry.
Okay,
they were
okay.
So yeah. Heated. So that's what I'm not going to guess.
Is a. My assumption is it's a goat that somehow betrays other goats.
You're not incorrect.
Does a Judas goat lead other goats to like slaughter?
Yeah, that's exactly what a Judas goat does.
Oh wow, that was really good.
Well, hey, let me tell you, great naming we got here.
Well, right, done, Tom.
Well done, Tom.
Oh, thank you. Hey, you know what? I don't feel good about being right.
It is really good naming.
Yeah, it's on point. So in the farming world, they're not just used for goat-on-goat slaughter.
Goat-on-goat violence!
They've had training, which means that they can herd other livestock. It's not just goats. They can work with sheep, cattle, things like that. In some cases, it can be a bit more sinister than that. Which, at this point, I do want to give a bit of a trigger warning for talking about animal death. And a bit of gallows humour as well. I know in my TikTok, everybody got a bit annoyed because I made a few jokes about this. It's probably going to happen here as well. So if you don't want to hear that sort of stuff, maybe skip forward to the next section.
I just want to put some context that people were, like, arguing that human beings should be used instead. and like being like human beings should die.
What?
Like, it was like it just got really like intense.
And maybe we'll touch on that a bit later as well, because that's a statement that annoys me to no end.
Also, for religious context, Judas was a
disciple.
Disciple?
Yep.
Who betrayed Jesus?
Yes, so there's like a traditionally, so he kisses Jesus, and that alerts to the Roman guards that that's who they need to, who Jesus is, and that's who they need to like grab.
Mm-hmm. I had no idea about that.
And that's called a Judas kiss. So like in The Godfather, it happens in like media all the time. It's very. And so these goats, they go up to the other animals, they kiss them.
They go up to another goat, give a little kiss. And then the humans come along and kill them.
They're like, this
come to me on the day of my.
So again, in terms of farming, these goats can be used to literally lead livestock to slaughterhouses. Makes it much easier for the farmers. Herds them, walks them over. The Judas goat gets to live because it's had training and everything. You don't want to waste all of those resources. So the Judas goat lives whilst all the other animals die, and the Judas goat gets used again for, like, the next round of animals, basically. So, now that we know in farming what a Judas goat is, can we think about how it might be used in conservation?
Oh! Also, I just want to say one quick note. Like, the fact that we collectively called them Judas goats and then continue to be like, this is good, is very interesting.
This is a good idea, yeah.
Like, we gave it the name of like, this is a bad thing, and then we're like, yeah.
I think other animals are also used, and like the technique itself is called a Judas steer or something like that. I might be incorrect. I'll double check.
It's really dark.
It's very, very dark.
Okay, the only thing I can think is, like, them, they lead animals around to different areas to get them away from places they shouldn't be, or to get them to places they should be, like they're herding dogs, you know.
Yeah,
it is a bit more sinister than that, unfortunately.
Oh
no,
boy.
No! I guess some background on goats. They became domesticated about 10,000 years ago. They survive really well, especially better than other herbivores. Thanks to, they have really low metabolism, they have an efficient digestive system, really low water requirements, and they can breed twice a year. So they can survive really well in quite desolate areas.
Can I just interject and say, people are sleeping on how fucking weird goats are.
Yeah.
Like, we, pick out a lot of different animals for our ire and disdain, like koalas and like blobfish or whatever. But goats are weird animals. They make the sounds they make are insane. Their tongues, they're always just going.
Their tongues are so much.
Don't they have the rectangular pupil, right?
Yeah, they do. They're freaky.
Oh yeah, that's fucked. That's fucked. Goats are fucked.
Just you wait, 2022, goats are gonna have their reckoning. That's the year.
I guess to add on to goat hate in this, like, is anybody gonna go away and be like, I hate goats now? Ugh.
I don't hate goats. I don't hate goats. I just think we should all be acknowledging more widely that they're weird animals.
Yeah. I love them for that.
Yeah, that's true. I do too. They're
weird. Anyway, so because goats are so sturdy, they've been introduced to a lot of islands, specifically, and this is one that I'm going to talk about quite a lot today, is the Galapagos Islands. Do either of you know, like, make a guess at who did it and why?
Darwin, because he hates the finches. he wanted
them to die.
I have to assume, I'm guessing it was Darwin, because...
Yeah, that's who I think of Is it not?
So, humans did introduce the goats, but it was people...
No, I didn't think they swam there.
I wouldn't put past goats. Have you seen them climb mountains and stuff?
They're weird. I believe that they could just teleport, you know? But it was pirates, it was whalers.
Pirates?
Yeah. In case they became stranded on the islands, they would have a meat source.
That's actually genius.
It's really smart, but also really fucked up.
And now there's loads of goats in the Galapagos and they shouldn't
now
be there.
Now there's loads of... Well, there were loads of goats in the Galapagos.
You know, I've always said that the worst thing about pirates is the ecological harm they cause on introducing species. That's the worst thing they've done, really. Cancelling pirates.
So, for some context about the Galapagos Islands as well, there are 18 main islands, 3 smaller islands. Obviously, they were the inspiration for Darwin's theory of evolution. There are 4, like, main islands that people live on, and the islands have a huge amount of biodiversity. There are some animals and plants that you can only find on these islands. And the goats came along and decided to fuck shit up. Woo! Woo! Basically, the goats ate... These pirate goats are like, you know what I'm going to do? Eat everything. Mm-hmm. So they ate everything, including, again, the plants that were endemic to the island. A lot of areas were quickly turned into grassland, including forested areas, because the goats were just eating all of the seedlings, basically. This, in turn, impacted the herbivores that lived on the island as well.
Right.
Because all of their food was being eaten. So the tortoises were being impacted, the iguanas, finches, and it had this huge ripple effect in the ecosystem. So that means that the goats had to go. So how did we get rid of the goats?
Eat the goats.
No, it was actually using aerial attack helicopters.
What?
Is that true?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what? Drone strike the goats!
This is the third left turn in this story. So to get to the original question, what is the point of Judas goats? The answer is attack helicopters.
Yeah,
obviously.
Duh.
Amazing.
So, Project Isabella was established in 1997, and the goal of it was eradicating...
That's so recent.
Yeah. The goal was to eradicate the goats and the donkeys from the largest islands.
Donkeys?
Yeah, donkeys also caused a similar problem, unfortunately.
Also cancelled.
Hashtag cancel donkeys, cancel goats. So in 1999, the goat eradication began on the island of Pinta, which is a small island, and it was used as a test. And they mainly used people like going around and hunting the goats. The eradication began on Santiago Island, which is a slightly larger island. And again, ground hunting was used. In 2004, we decided that the ground hunting wasn't doing a good enough job. So we brought in helicopters and we had people on the helicopters literally shooting the goats, unfortunately.
Does anyone live on the Galapagos Islands?
Yeah, so on four of the large islands, I think it's 25,000 people, yeah.
So they're just dealing with like what I imagine is thousands of dead goats.
Pretty much, yeah.
Just like piling up.
That's true. Shooting a goat doesn't... The goats don't despawn in real life, yeah. Sadly. they still are there. Huh.
I will talk about what happens to the dead goats afterwards, but it's not...
Oh, good,
it's
okay.
It's not ideal.
Jesus.
So, in 2004, the aerial hunting begins. The goats are getting shot. As the number of goats decreases, it gets harder and harder to find the goats. The goats are separating up into small groups and they would hide together.
Oh,
and
no.
And this is where the Judas goats come in.
Oh, God.
Oh!
That's, first of all, that's fucking diabolical. That's genius. Mm-hmm. But also, mm-hmm. Poor goats.
It's heartbreaking. And I will also talk about the impact this has on the Judas goats in a minute because it is heartbreaking.
Oh, my God. The Judas goats get psychologically damaged.
Oh. This is back when Disney used to do like really, really like more sinister movies. Like this is very easily like an 80s Disney movie.
Yeah.
Because it's tragic.
Oh, God.
So,
oh, boy.
What they did was they would take a goat from the island. They would sterilize the goat so the goat couldn't breed. And they put a tracking collar around the goat's neck. And then they would then release the goat back onto the island again. Goats are really, really social animals. They really like being around other goats. So these Judas goats would then go and find all of their friends, leading the hunters straight to the rest of the goats, basically. So every 2 weeks, people would go out and follow the goats, like tracking the goat, and then kill any goats that they found around that goat. And then they'd let the Judas goat out again. So they reused the same goat pretty much every single time.
Oh my god, this goat is gonna be fucking traumatized. You just go...
Yep.
It makes friends. Like, goats can form bonds. Like, they have...
Yeah.
And he'll go and, like, bond with all the other goats. And then they just kill them all. And like, all right then, fuck off to the next lot.
Off you go again. Yeah. It's really heartbreaking. Oh. So... In 2004, they had 200 Judas goats on Santiago Island. In 2004, the hunting began on Island Isabella as well. They eradicated 55,000 goats during the early part of the eradication process on this island. And they used 770 Judas goats here. So there's a lot of Judas goats being used. In 2005... The goats have been pretty much completely removed from both Santiago and Isabella. The goats were removed in 2003 for Pinta Island. In 2006, it was declared that they had been completely eradicated. And 266 Judas goats got to remain on Island Isabella for monitoring purposes. So basically, it worked really, really well.
It worked too well.
Yeah. They eradicated, I think it's 99% of the goat population on these islands, which some, I've read a few articles on it, some say between, I think it was 140 to 200,000 goats.
Jesus. That's bonkers.
And these goats, some of them were used by the people who lived on the islands, obviously, but a lot of them were just left to decompose on the islands as well.
Did that have any ecological effect, or did it just
it
kind of like...
It didn't,
just...
from what I read, bizarrely. But I did think it was important to mention because a lot of people were asking what happened to the goats after they were killed.
Yeah.
If there's hundreds of thousands of them, I thought maybe, you know, they'd like get rid of them, but no.
No, I think they left the majority of them there to decompose on the island.
Good for the soil.
I guess
so.
But the ecosystems did bounce back really, really quickly after the goat eradication. And some plants that they thought had been lost from the island almost came back and bounced back as well. So it did the thing we wanted it to do, but it feels a little bit icky. There are also the negative impacts on the Judas goat itself. which are capture, handling, and restraint can cause anxiety and injury to the animals. The nearby shooting of cohorts can distress the goat.
No shit, right?
And the sound of the gunshots can also cause more anxiety. And this one broke my heart. Repeatedly being isolated and having to find other goats can cause fear and anxiety, as the goats are highly sociable animals.
Oh. This is worse than the chimera stuff, Caroline.
Yeah, I didn't think we'd have two really heavy topics, one after the other.
And then the third one be toys.
Yeah, we need
it. You know what, fine, at least we're ending the light note.
So, I kind of want to know what your thoughts are on the eradication of invasive species like this. Because on one hand, obviously, you're saving an entire ecosystem of plants, animals, etc. But also, this is a pretty brutal way of doing it.
I have actually a very personal stance on the eradication of invasive species, which I'm sure you weren't expecting.
Please.
Okay, can you see that? For the tape, I am now unclothing myself slightly. Let me see self view. Okay, can you see this?
Oh, it's a tattoo. Yeah, it's a tattoo of an attack helicopter.
Yeah, that's it. This is a tattoo of a ring-necked parakeet. They're an invasive species in the south of England, particularly in London. Yeah. They aren't hugely detrimental to, like, native birds, but they are in some ways. Birds that, like, live in holes, like woodpeckers, they kick them out of the holes to like, lay their eggs. They don't compete for food or anything like that, but that's one of the ways they've affected them. And they are incredibly hardy birds. They probably expanded in the UK because of pests, like because of they were pets. People like released them, and because of climate change, especially like the south of England or England and the UK as a whole is like much warmer. So they are much better at like surviving here than they would have been previously. Because this only happened like the last 30 years, like 20 years. There is kind of like talk of doing like a cull.
Oh, I didn't know that.
First of all, I love these birds. I think they're beautiful.
Yeah.
And they're really interesting thing to see in like the UK. And I disagree with the idea of a cull because it's our fault they're here.
Yeah.
And like the idea that they've come here and managed to thrive. Like there are other conservation efforts we should be making with British birds.
Yeah.
That are affected by them, that doesn't mean culling this population of bird. If there has to be like, if there's a way to reduce this the population of ringnecked parakeets, fine, but I don't think it should be with a cull. I certainly don't agree with the absolute obliteration of 99% of a species that was introduced by humans.
Do you also think maybe because we were the ones who introduced them? I guess I get what you're saying, because I'm also a bit like, it's definitely our responsibility to sort the problem out.
Yeah.
And with the Galapagos Islands especially, it's really difficult to get onto the island as humans, especially for some of the islands. So I'm curious, maybe if you've had any off the top of your head thoughts about how else we might have dealt with this situation, other than shooting them from a helicopter?
I don't know. Maybe breeding, like preventing breeding in some way. Reducing the population without...
Yeah,
like slaughtering hundreds of thousands of animals, probably.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really easy to say that.
Yeah.
And then it's really difficult to think of another solution, because sterilization, in theory, is great, but you've then got to sterilize hundreds of thousands of animals before they can breed and, you know, get out of control again. Moving them is also really difficult because they are an invasive species in a lot of other places as well. So whilst I don't necessarily agree with... Like, it makes me feel really icky, but also it's a bit like, what else can you do? There are other examples of stuff like this. Like, I did a video on hedgehogs in the Outer Hebrides, pretty much straight after I did this video on the goats. For context, hedgehogs in the Outer Hebrides are a really, really invasive animal. But everybody in the UK loves hedgehogs. They're an endangered animal for the rest of mainland Britain. So there was a hedgehog cull for a while in the Outer Hebrides. And now we relocate the hedgehogs instead. It's more expensive. It takes longer. But it feels a lot better. Yeah.
Are goats endangered anywhere? I don't think
so,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It is a really difficult thing. Like, it feels horrible, and I understand the necessity of it for, like, conservation of native wildlife, but there is, like, mm-hmm. also this huge part of me, like, with the parakeets, which is, like, why do... this all comes back to, why do we get a say in, like, what invasive species gets to be where? We're a massively invasive species that affects, like, habitats mm-hmm. of other animals all the time. And I guess I know that that's, like, a weak kind of, we should be protecting.
Yeah.
Especially since we introduced them, so we should be protecting other wildlife from it. But, like, in my head, I'm just like, it really does.
It's really, really icky. Completely agree with that, yeah. And, like, every other example of it, it always feels icky. And it's great when another solution can be found.
The hedgehog one, that's great. I love that.
Yeah, I love that one.
I mean, I feel like another answer to this is being more conscious about these situations going forward.
Yeah.
Probably the best step mm-hmm. we can do next is have fewer pirates with goats.
Yeah.
Or other situations like that.
I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but I do know that these goats do still get moved around. And, like, in places like Australia...
What, by pirates?
Not by pirates.
Would you download a goat? Those pirates. Torrenting goats everywhere.
Yeah, I fucking would download a goat.
But goats are still being introduced to other places as a food source for humans. And it's a bit like, why the fuck are we still doing that when we've seen this happen so many times?
This is the issue, like, between, like, developed and non-developed nations. If that is the... I'm not sure what the correct terminology is anymore, but in developed nations, maybe we're considering the conservation of, like, like areas and animals and nature. But in less developed nations, like, there's still, like, basic needs that need to be met.
Yeah, and what's more important? Yeah.
The thing is, I don't believe either is more important, but I think if we want to conserve nature, then we have to meet the basic needs of humans mm-hmm. who use nature in a negative way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, in India, which has, like, a very high rate of pollution, right? That's because mm-hmm. they, in a lot of cases, don't have, like, the technology or the resources to reduce that. And what we can do is help in that case. I say we. I'm not trying to come in as, like, a white Western savior thing. I mean, all developed nations need to be supporting less developed nations to meet these kind of goals for conservation.
Absolutely.
And you, mm-hmm. to do that, you have to help other human beings.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
What a concept!
I think just education in general is such a huge thing that would be so helpful in these sorts of scenarios as well. And not just for, like, less developed nations, but for us as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Talking about this
agree.
So much more.
Because it turns out we all live in the world.
We all do this shit. With the Outer Hebrides example, it was a postman who saw that hedgehogs ate slugs, so he introduced two hedgehogs to his greenhouse. Oh. And now there are, like, 5,000 hedgehogs on the Outer Hebrides. So education just to prevent things like that from happening.
I mean, that's really, that is really cute, though.
It's a really cute but really dumb thing to have happened. Rhododendron is another, like, massively invasive species that humans can just walk around on the bottom of their shoe and spread to forests and stuff.
I feel like most invasive species are just because people had, like, wanted pets or wanted a nice flower or whatever.
Terrapins
became...
in England as well. Like, after Ninja Turtles was a thing, everybody wanted a pet terrapin.
No way.
Everybody wanted a pet terrapin. Everybody got a pet terrapin, and then terrapins were getting released into ponds in the UK, which is why we have terrapins here. We shouldn't. They're really bad for the environment, but it's another one of those examples of everybody really likes terrapins. So it's really difficult to get anything done about them. Everybody's like, whoa, a turtle. And actually it's like, that really shouldn't be there.
This is what happened with the parakeets.
Yeah, yeah.
So, pet parakeets, people that are just escaping. That's mm-hmm. it. That's the whole thing.
It's all it is. there is one final thing that I would like to... The wolves in Yellowstone National Park is a really interesting, like, sort of different case study.
I don't know
about
these. Yeah.
So we removed the wolves from Yellowstone National Park because they were a nuisance. So humans did that. Humans did the goof, which led to, I think it was deer populations getting completely out of control and decimating the park in like large parts. So we reintroduced the wolves to Yellowstone National Park and they controlled that population. A similar thing happened in the Galapagos Islands with rats, where humans accidentally introduced the rats. So...
Oh, someone ratatouille'd them?
Absolutely, yeah.
brought them in under their chef's hat.
So we introduced cats to kill the rats.
Yes.
Then we introduced dogs to kill the cats, and we introduced goats to kill the dogs, then horses to kill the goats, and then... No, it's like the woman who swallowed a fly. Why did she swallow a fly? And then she swallowed a spider, and she falls.
We did actually introduce cats to try and deal with the problem.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
And
you know,
obviously,
you know the issue.
We
also,
all know
cats
the issues
are, cats
here.
Cats are terrible for the environment. They absolutely just decimate environments.
Well, rats and cats are both terrible for the Galapagos Islands in particular because there's a lot of ground nesting birds there who never have dealt with predators before.
Oh, no.
So wait, what ended up happening with the cats and the rats?
There's still a problem there.
Great, excellent. Yeah. So that's a real...
So... With, like, the Yellowstone National Park example, it's, like, kind of the perfect conservation thing because we are just reintroducing the species which deal with the problem and they're where they should be and all of this stuff. And it's kind of like...
Did none of these people, like, take basic biology lessons? Because it's, like, one of the first things you learn about the, you know, the cycle, the predation, prey, like, predator-prey cycle. If you take away the predator... The prey expands.
The prey's gonna get... Yeah, so we thought we'd be able to deal with the deer problem ourselves through hunting. No. No,
also, wolves are a nuisance. That doesn't mean you don't get to, like, get rid of them.
Doesn't mean you get to eradicate a whole species. What? But humans are... We play God quite a lot with nature.
Or did you hear that they're thinking of... This is, like, way off in the future, but they're thinking of reintroducing wolves to the UK?
And lynxes as well.
Yeah, the UK used to have so many like predator animals that like it doesn't anymore. So
we do get beavers though.
Wow,
beavers are being introduced to the UK, and that's very exciting.
Oh, are they actually? Oh,
yeah,
coming 2022.
Yeah, literally next year.
Actually,
not far away from where I live.
literally in 2022, they're reintroducing beavers. Great, coming to a damn near you.
Woo. But I guess same thing again, if anybody does want to share their thoughts on this with any of the examples I've brought up today, mention it in the Discord server. Because there's no wrong answer here. You're allowed to be angry about this sort of conservation stuff. But I also think it's really useful to be aware of like what conservationists at least consider sometimes. Like this will be my job one day. Yeah.
It's what's being done. Mm-hmm. And that's the truth of the matter. Yeah. Is that did happen.
That did happen. Yeah. And like, not every conservationist is this like hippie vegan trying to save all of the animals, which I think is quite a common misconception in the UK, is like, oh, you must love all animals. And it's like, this is the sort of stuff we're learning about, unfortunately, in like universities and stuff like that when considering doing these jobs. So that's really interesting.
This did not go where I thought it was going to go. And it was very interesting.
No.
And it's such an interesting case study.
Wouldn't it be great if I had called that out? Called out attack helicopters right from the start?
Straight away.
So today's miscellaneous topic is toys. And this started off as like a simple thing, you know, miscellaneous topic for a holiday episode. But it turns out that toy history is really, really challenging. So when it comes to modern day toys, there's no central list of like the top toys because every toy company only puts out numbers that make them look good. So they aren't voluntarily like getting together and showing each other their numbers. So every list you find is full of speculation and corporate nonsense. And even toy history is a really incoherent mess. I was looking up the history of the yo-yo, and a constant thing I kept hearing was, it is believed that the yo-yo originated in China. And like, that's...
What does that mean?
That's not anything. I learned that phrases like that are called weasel words.
Weasel words. That's nice. I'm going
to
use that.
It's when you try to make your opinion sound like the general opinion. Like, it is believed that Let's Learn Everything is the best podcast.
And it's literally like, it is believed by me.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying people believe that. And you find that all the time. Like, all the sources are like, tomsyoyowebsite.net or like a single placard at a museum.
Is that your website? Did you make that?
I need you all to be honest. Do I look like a person who was into yo-yos, or how obvious was how apparent was it that I was really into yo-yos? Because I was.
Oh, I thought you were gonna ask us, because I would have said like, yes, you look like the kind of person who
who has them right over there off screen.
Oh, this already sounds like I'm about to fucking drag you. You know, like, I've tried to use yo-yos and I can't use them, so it really just comes from a place of jealousy. People are the kind of person who does, like, tries to do, like, sick tricks with yo-yos on, like, the playground. And it's like, look at my sick yo-yo tricks. And you're, like, flicking them out and, like, spinning them around.
Did you have, like, proper yo-yos? Like, the weighted ones and everything?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Do they flash? Oh my god!
For anybody who's listening, Tom's doing some sick tricks for us right now. He fucked up his sick trick, bro.
Yeah, he literally got the first one wrong, but... Oh, here we go. Oh my god!
Oh my god!
There we go. And then this.
Oh my god, he's like spinning. He's like, you know, and they put the string into like a triangle shape, and he's flicking the yo-yo around all over the place.
This one's my favorite.
Oh, that's so good.
Have you practiced these recently?
Wonderful for an audio podcast.
This is a TikTok clip right here. Okay?
You can tell it's real, because if it was anything less than good, y'all would be roasting me to hell and back. So that's how you can tell.
That's very true. Yeah. Honestly, Tom, that was impressive.
I loved that. Thank you.
So, all of this is to say, the issue is that toy history and toy research isn't given a lot of respect. You know, instead of articles and journals, it is like toy company websites are like the arbiter of toy history. And I think that toys deserve academic respect. You know, in the US, kids under 12 make up 15% of the population, and the other 85% were children at one point.
So, I don't know what you're talking about.
I've always been a 20-year-old.
I came out like this.
Yeah.
So where this becomes an even bigger issue is when we go from toy history to toy prehistory. So I found a really fascinating paper by Michelle Langley and Marani Litster titled, "Is It Ritual or Is It Children?" So this is a quote from the paper. "Applying the adage, it's ritual, to any object or pattern in the archaeological record that cannot be explained by economic or technological activities has long been commonplace in archaeology. And while in many cases such interpretations may be correct, we researchers routinely overlooked another agent that equally, and perhaps more frequently, can be responsible for such discoveries. Children." And so, my favorite example of this is the split twig figures. I'll send y'all a picture real quick. They're really cute.
Oh, wow.
They're made by taking flexible twigs, like from a willow tree, and splitting them and bending them and wrapping them into shapes. They're so cute. They're like little animals.
Yeah.
So, they were found by the Grand Canyon and the Southwest U.S. and date back anywhere from 1000 to 2000 BCE. Before the Common Era. And so the consensus originally was that these were ritualistically significant. And one researcher described the location where they were found like this. They said, "The ceiling of the overhang is very low, and most of the occupational evidence was found near the mouth. The figurines, however, were scattered throughout the less accessible portions of the shelter." And so because they were in these like hard-to-find places and they were grouped together, a lot of folks thought that they had ritualistic significance, but
they were just toys.
Other researchers thought, you know, who else is famous for being able to get into hard-to-reach places and for hiding things are children.
Definitely children.
That's so cute.
They've also been found, you know, in burial sites with children, and so that's another hint. But, you know, you can never say for certain, but it raises a really interesting point in archaeology, which is, on the one hand, we want to respect and not diminish parts of ancient cultures as being like just toys. But on the other hand, you want to respect them enough to realize that these cultures are full enough to also include whimsy, right?
I feel like it's like less respectful to assume that everything is ritualistic.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like it takes away like a human aspect of like ancient cultures.
Exactly.
Like that they had children and people who wanted to play and like have fun and enjoy themselves like we do.
100%. And the other thing is that just because it's a toy doesn't make it unimportant. Like, that's amazing. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And that gives us a glimpse into a unique part, a facet of the full culture. And yeah, exactly, Ella. Mm-hmm. So I did my best to try to treat these ancient toys with the importance that they deserve and collect as many kinds as I could find. Some of the sources out there are flimsy, but I did my best to only include them here if they were multiple confirmed examples of it. So this is an incomplete list, but what do y'all think some of the earliest toys were? There are some surprising ones in this list, but I'm gonna let y'all...
Marbles?
Ooh,
yes.
That's a great shout. Yeah.
So marbles and balls obviously are found. They're a little hard to find in the archaeological record because a common source of marbles were... we have some records of this, of peach and cherry pits.
Oh!
Uh-huh.
So there's a line from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night that goes,
"What man, 'tis not for gravity to play at cherry pits with Satan."
Oh my goodness.
Well, I want to give some British toy background to you, Tom.
Oh yes, please.
You might appreciate this. I don't know, you might do this in the US, but this word feels very British. Do you know what a conker is?
No idea. Absolutely not.
Conker is a great shout.
So the conker is the seed of the inside. What tree does it come from, Caroline?
Is it horse chestnut?
Okay, so conkers, they're like big, the big seeds that come inside like these spiky balls. And we have loads of horse chestnut trees here. They fall. And then what we do is you get the fresh conkers, which are very shiny and nice, and you drill a hole through it. You put a piece of string or a little, like a shoelace through. You tie it up.
Uh-huh.
So you've got a conker, like the seed, big, it's big, at the end of this rope.
Yeah.
And then you face off against another person and you bash them together. You, like, throw them at each other like they're Beyblades. And then when they're... and when they hit each other, like, you basically, you have to see... get the stronger conker, the one that doesn't smash wins.
I love
and people
this.
Would, like, reinforce their conkers with like nail varnish, and
yeah, we used to boil ours in vinegar.
Boil him.
Mm-hmm.
Ella, it's really funny you mentioned Beyblades because another really common toy from and this is found across cultures are spinning tops, and they're really identifiable because they spin and they have identifiable features.
Well, this makes sense because of in the religious context, right? Dreidels, is that what they're called in Judaism? So that's they have been around a very long time, and I'm sure they've been. Are dreidels toys?
Yeah, they're used to play a game. I learned this from a TikTok, so I mean, I'm regurgitating, but they are used to play a specific game. Yeah,
spinning tops. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah,
that's a really good one. You mentioned, was it last time? Early dice?
Yes, yeah. Similar to balls, yeah. And that sort of goes into the realm of games also. You know, I don't know if that's necessarily a toy. There were some years as a child I would have hated to get a board game as a toy, but early games of...
Really? I loved getting a new board game when I was
now
a kid.
Now I love them, but they're as a kid sometimes. In ancient Egypt, Senet, from around 3000 BCE, is one of the earliest board games that we have actual, like, physical records of. Also the royal game of Ur in the Middle East around the same time. And what I found really unintuitive but also makes perfect sense is that bowling is really old.
Oh,
Skittles. But yes, Skittles specifically,
exactly.
Right? It would be... Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like, just knocking something down with
a
ball.
Exactly. Yeah, that's like...
And seeing who's the best at it, yeah.
But at the same time, like, I feel like bowling alleys are so... like 90, like have such a vibe.
It feels so modern,
right?
I agree, but you're again. I think this comes back to like Skittles is like a game that old men play on grass. So like, which is so it's just like outdoor bowling, right? But that's where it. And so in my head, I see it as that rather than the 90s.
Totally.
And
then
yeah.
When you think about it like that, it's like what is older than throwing things at other things, right?
Yeah.
Do y'all have any other guesses for early toys?
I have a few more. In the U.S., the National Toy Hall of Fame inducted in 2008 the stick as the oldest toy. I think that's cute.
I love that. The other one was dolls.
Dolls, like, yes.
Oh, dolls.
Dolls,
yeah,
is a huge one. If there was one I had to, if like, obviously the record is really messy and incomplete, but if I had to pick one that I thought would be the first toy, I would say it is a doll. There are so many, mm-hmm, from so many cultures. And I have gone, in doing this, I've gotten such an appreciation for dolls. Like, it's such a fascinating view into a specific culture, because it shows one, how you dress the doll, which is like dependent on your history, yeah, and also the climate, but also
dressing the little dolls. Sorry, I'm just imagining, like, from cold climates, yeah, they dress, yeah, little dolls in little coats and
also, what's amazing is the materials you have in your area. So there are corn husk dolls, there are dolls made of wood, made of soapstone, made of bone. That I've gone through such a wormhole of looking through all these dolls and, like, animal figures also.
I want to describe for the listeners that Tom's little face right now talking about dolls is genuinely the brightest and most excited I've ever seen his face. Like, you genuinely look like you're in love with the dolls.
It's because it's amazing. It's just so cool. It's so cool. Instruments was also a big one. Rattles, whistles, drums. Of all of these, I think the one that is, well, the one that for me that is the most surprising by far, it's amazing, is toy cars. But of course, they weren't cars. They were toy carts. But there are examples of these. Like, there was a Greek horse on wheels from 900 BCE. There are toy carts from Iran that date back to around 1500 BC. But my favorite of these.
Sorry, 1500 BC.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It is. And this is the one I'm going to insist that you Google for this image. My favorite of these toy carts was brought to my attention by a friend of the show, Ash, or Trash Bandicoot on TikTok. So I would love, if you want a little joy in your life, I would Google ancient hedgehog cart and see what comes up.
That's the sweetest thing I've ever seen. That is just delightful.
Oh my goodness, it's so cute!
It's amazing!
Oh, I like the lion one.
this one dates back to Iran from 1500 BCE. And it's...
Oh, wow!
It's amazing, and it's so cute. It's so cute, and it's a so little cart sweet with wheels, and it's amazing!
Things like this make, like, history, like, so much more human to me.
Yeah,
like,
it really, exactly.
Like, puts so much emotion into it. Like, there's a little kid. There was, like, a little tiny person playing with this little tiny hedgehog.
I would play with that.
There was a little kid who just really wanted a tiny little toy hedgehog. So somebody around him made a tiny little toy hedgehog.
Oh,
I love that so much.
A little hedgehog riding in a cart.
Oh!
Let me see what else. Yo-yos, I mentioned this, are they're surprisingly old. There are clay yo-yos from ancient Greece.
Wow.
That date back to around 400 BCE, which I guess makes sense.
What did they use for string? Did they have No, don't. That's the stupidest question I've ever asked. But there's string. They had string.
No, but I mean, and it's important to realize these things. We have these assumptions that, like, what is modern, what isn't.
I like to think that, like, in a playground, where was this ancient Greece?
Yeah.
There was just this, like, kid
doing tricks.
These yo-yo tricks. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think, I like to look back and think that maybe if I was in ancient Greece, I would have been cool with my yo-yo stuff. So, to bring it back to the split twig figures, you know, we can never, it's impossible to say for certain that these were toys. But what I find really beautiful is that we do know for certain that they are toys now, because you can get split twig figurine kits today that teach you how to make them and fold them.
Oh.
And I think that's really, like, cosmically beautiful that these toys, but also so many of these, are, like, literally unchanged. Like Beyblades, yeah, are literally, they're just, it's just tops.
I love Beyblades. Oh, I love Beyblade. I had like the Beyblade arena.
Well, okay, yes. this is where we're going next, because I wanted to ask, what were some of y'all's favorite toys and first toys, if you can remember? Ooh. You had the Beyblade arena. You were into...
I love Beyblades, Digimon and Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh, Ella. Right?
Ella, you're really fucking cool.
Thanks. I know. I had, you know what my favorite toy was to this day? I think about it
yes.
all the time.
Oh, please.
I had the Yu-Gi-Oh, like, card
You
deck,
had the dual disc?
Which, like, yeah, so, like, you wear it on your arm and then it, like, Ella. Flips out and you get to, like, and it ejects cards.
I wanted that so bad.
Oh, my God.
I loved that thing. That thing was amazing. Wow. And I used to run around, like, yeah, shooting cards off my fucking deck. That was sick.
That's so cool.
I am literally so jealous now. I wanted that so bad. This was it was called the Dual Disc. Wow. Major nerd cred. Yeah. I asked my dad, actually, what my first toy was. And he said it was... He said we went to a now defunct toy store called Zany Brainy. And apparently the first toy I got was a Thomas the Tank Engine. Makes sense. But
classic.
It wasn't a Thomas. It was a Henry for some reason. The green one. And
the green one, yeah.
What the fuck?
I asked him, I said, oh, because I like the show. We watched the show. And he was like, no, we had never watched or read the show or read any books about it. I just really, really clung on to that anthropomorphic train.
Well, you know when little boys, they either get interested in dinosaurs, trains, or like... ancient
yeah,
Egypt.
Yeah, that's where. So that's like, where, that's where my paths diverged. Yeah,
you strike me as a train boy.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Oh, Caroline, you haven't said what yours was.
I don't know what my first toy was. I know what the oldest toy I currently have is. Like that was mine. It's this like grey rabbit holding onto a carrot. Its name's Emily. And the reason I have Emily is because I did have a rabbit before her. And whilst I was being pushed on a walk in a pushchair, I took the rabbit and I threw it into a canal.
Sorry, your...
The toy rabbit?
Sorry, it wasn't a real rabbit. It was a toy.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a toy rabbit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought you'd got a real rabbit.
Oh, no. I had a toy rabbit before Emily.
So this is Emily 2.
And I threw her into the canal. Yeah, so this is Emily number 2. So I'm aware of an older toy that I then chucked into a canal,
I mean,
basically.
Okay, so the oldest toys most people will have are like teddy bears, right? Like some kind of like stuffed animal. Is there a history of that, you know?
Oh, of people holding onto the... Oh, I like that.
Because I know that there is... I know the, like, vague history of, like, the actual teddy bear. You know, the one with, like, the stiff arms and ears. But, like, is there, like a soft plush kind of history?
So the issue is that the softer a material is, the harder it is for them to be sustained.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There are examples of dolls that people... They look like stone portions, and they believe that they used to have like rope hair or a clothing made from like leaves and stuff like that. So it's hard to find the record on some of those softer items and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, things like balls and sticks, which could have been the first toys that you can't, because like a toy at a certain point becomes something that a person has to imbue with meaning, right? So it's hard to hard for that record.
I can't imagine that. Throughout history, there wasn't a point where people weren't making like soft toys for children, right?
I feel like as soon as we were making clothes,
yeah.
we were probably making soft toys as well, yeah.
And also Transformers, probably. That was probably early on.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, of course,
Pokemon cards.
Is there any evidence of us like making like these more fantastical animals as toys, like unicorns or something like that? Like,
dragons.
What's the earliest thing of a toy? Yeah, exactly, like a toy dragon.
I bet things like dragons were pretty early, because if it was in the mythology of the time, people would have made things like that for fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's also, some of these are very interpretive, and so it's hard to guess at. Like, even the split twig figures, they kind of look silly.
They could be.
Yeah, it's hard to get that intention from there. Video games were also very, very big for me. I have very few recurring dreams. The only recurring dream I consistently have is that it's a dream where I'm playing a new Super Smash Bros. And I'm seeing all the new characters. Because that's like a primal memory and joy in my life from LIUK.
Oh my god.
You knew I was a dork going into this.
That's just like that really just like summarizes you as a person.
Yeah,
I love you even more for it. Amazing.
That single sentence is like the baby shoes never worn of describing me. Like, it's just a short sentence that sums it up.
Let me tell you about one of the strongest memories I have playing with toys when I was youngest. I was like, I had like quite a dichotomy between my love of like Pokemon and Digimon and my love of like Bratz dolls. and like dressing them up. I really like traditional like girly things, but also like adventure things, right? And I merged them together. I used to like have play with them. in a town. They used to live in a town together, right? They would interact with each other, the Bratz dolls, but then the Digimon, which, by the way, these Digimon toys are amazing, because they could, like, change shape into the different, like, evolutions of the Digimon.
Whoa!
Yeah, that's really cool. Absolutely sick. And I remember this one time, this stuck in my head for so long, it's so bad. I had this lamp, which I used to the sun, okay? I turned the sun off, right? And they were, the people were telling, like, what's happening? Why isn't the sun? Where's the sun gone? The sun, what are we gonna do? We're gonna have to sacrifice someone.
Ella.
Oh my god!
So I've got my Bratz doll. She's like this. And starfish, and they sacrifice her to the sun god to turn the lamp sun back on. It's one of my earliest memories playing with toys. I must have been about.
This checks out.
7 years old. But yeah,
wow.
That's a rich
narrative. That was a weird
there.
One.
That's a lot. That's a lot to take in.
Yeah, I used to like create whole laws for like my also Bionicles. I had loads of Bionicles. You know the Bionicles.
Oh yeah.
Their Bionicles are so cool. I want a Bionicle toy again, man. This is like my Barbie's Bratz Bionicles Digimon Pokemon Town. Where they all live, like, peacefully together. But until they're not peaceful anymore.
Until the sun turned off.
Oh, man.
I'm just gonna list a few from a list of some of the top toys. This is from Business Insider, and their source is Toy Insider. So, you know, grain of salt, these numbers are extremely inconsistent, but it is a list. So from the 1980s, we have the Rubik's Cube.
Mm-hmm. I can believe that.
And we have Cabbage Patch Kids, Trivial Pursuit.
Is it weird? I don't consider the Rubik's Cube that much of a toy. Like, I guess you could call puzzles toys in a way, but like, Rubik's Cubes, people take them really fucking seriously.
Yeah.
They do, yeah.
But I guess people take everything. Like, I feel like a lot of the main toys.
Oh, that's true. Now, yeah, collectors
and stuff.
That's
true. People take Pokemon cards seriously. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god, yeah.
Transformers/GoBots, which apparently they then merged together to become one thing. So,
oh, you know,
never heard of GoBots.
Maybe that's a main topic for another time. My Little Pony, Nintendo, Game Boy, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Pogs, mm-hmm. Beanie Babies, big into Beanie Babies. Loved the bat.
Beanie Babies! Bat even I collected Beanie Babies for a while. Everyone did.
I was not a Beanie Babies kid. I don't think I was a Beanie Babies kid.
Tickle Me Elmo, Tamagotchis.
Oh, wow. Tamagotchi! Oh, Tamagotchi kids, so.
Yeah.
Yes. I want one now. Like, they've done like a research.
Yeah,
really. There's like a new generation, but I got one for a friend a couple of years ago, and they're not as good. But maybe it's just because I'm older now.
Maybe it's nostalgia. Yeah.
Oh, you mean you can't buy your childhood back? I was really hoping you could. Pokemon, Razor Scooters, Bratz Dolls, the Nintendo Wii, Webkinz, Silly Bands, and then Zuzu Pets was the most recent one they had on their list. That's fully out of my...
Zuzu Pets?
Listen, there are some Gen Z kids that you know are going to be screaming and being like, oh, I love... I guess I have no concept of them.
I don't know if this phenomenon came to the US, but we had these, like, They're called Scoobies. Do you remember Scoobies?
Yeah. No idea what you're talking. Yeah. Absolutely lost on me.
They're like kind of rubbery plastic.
They're like elastic bands, but small.
Yeah, but they're not really elastic. And you used to braid them and like, yeah. And that's it. That's the
you
whole thing.
You make like bracelets out of them and
they
everything.
They were like huge. Like all girls are like making Scooby like things and
I remember
them.
Being 16 and having one of those whilst I was doing National Citizen Service. I was sat in the hotel with my friends just making these.
You did National
bands.
Citizen Service?
I did, yeah.
I was a counsellor on National Citizen Service.
No.
I never did it, but goodness. I was one of the
Oh my god.
National Citizen Service is not what it sounds really weird. But it's basically like, summer camp that the government funded.
Yeah.
And I hate that they call it National cool. Citizen Service because it makes it sound like young, like British Army stuff. Uh-huh. Like,
you literally, like, I went off and volunteered at a homeless shelter. Oh. Like, it was really wholesome.
Well, I was going to ask if there were any uniquely British toys versus American toys.
Well, you've heard
toys.
What Scoobies and Conkers, which is still.
Right. Yeah.
Conkers is like, I love so
Conkers
much.
Conkers gets. Banned in school sometimes.
Yeah, because so people really go for
it. I just remembered.
The fact that it's like a thing that our parents played and like we're still everyone yeah. has done it for so long, I just love that.
In grade school in second or third grade, Beyblades got banned. And so me and a group of friends met with the principal and did a presentation on the safety and joy of Beyblades. And
Oh my god.
I remember in the hallways spinning a Beyblade to demonstrate to my principal how it works and how it's like, it's just like a spinning top. And see, and it's fun and it does that. And we were not successful.
Oh, that's... I feel like if kids brought a presentation to me about why they were the toys were okay, I would absolutely let them play with
I'd
the
have
toys.
To just be like, you know what, it's fine.
That's so fucking cute. Away. That's
okay.
So cute.
Did you have Polly Pocket?
Yes, we did. We had those in the US. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Polly Pocket. So also, there was a TikTok. There's a TikTok I saw a couple of days ago, which was apparently the universal feeling of like, which of, it was like a picture of all the different Polly Pocket clothes. And it was like, which of these is best to chew on?
Oh my god, it was always the shoes. Okay, I'm just saying.
Some people like the orange dress. And I was like, yeah, the orange dress was so good to chew on.
I kind of want to talk about, like, the future of toys a little bit. Because, like, I know you've seen, like, Barbie dolls and stuff like that being a lot more inclusive and things. And, like, pregnant Barbie dolls and stuff like that.
I'm trying to make the shape of them, like,
more human,
right?
Uh-huh. And I'm just curious, like, where do you guys think toys are going to go in the future? Like, what are people going to have? Obviously, it'll be, like, the same sort of stuff, but... different, I guess.
I think obviously, like if you count games, like gaming as toys, then like that's where like a lot of stuff is going, right? But when you, I'm surprised. I've been seeing adverts for like these little, they're kind of like horse doll things with like sparkly eyes or whatever, and kids don't actually change that much, surprisingly.
Yeah,
yeah.
And like things repeat themselves. Like having little horse, like a lot of like little girls will always want. Dolls and will always want horses, right? And all children.
I was gonna say there's something now about like a lot of toys being marketed to everyone.
I actually completely agree. Yes, I think that's a good point. In the future, I think we probably will see less like gendered marketing, which is a good thing. And particularly, I hope with one of the things in the last 20 years has been like science toys, like chemistry sets and like like little microscopes and little the marketing for that has always been like very very like boy focused.
Yeah,
even though that is such like a genderless thing, like to me that's like
it's
that doesn't make any sense.
Man.
Like, I can get a car, but like a microscope.
My friend had a toy microscope when I was growing up, and I thought it was the coolest thing
I'd be so jealous.
Yeah. I really wanted one, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could only ever see my eyelashes on it, but it was still really cool.
Same, yeah.
Yeah.
We should talk about microscopes for another episode, because I feel like, I mean, obviously Ella has a lot of info about them, and I'm always so curious.
Yeah.
I think that is a good, like, I feel like a lot of articles are like,
you know, like, they're very toy dystopic, right? It's like, technology is killing joy. But I will say, like, the fact that, like, even, like, video cameras as a kid, like, I was one of the, I remember I made videos all the time with, like, my stuffed animals and stuff like that. And I think those are amazing. And again, with, like, microscopes and being able for these technologies to make more things more accessible, I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I remember I have full confidence in the ability of children to make chaos given whatever circumstances they have. Like, I remember we were having this discussion once in school, I think in college, about, like, you know, like, toys and like the future, like Black Mirror stuff, and someone brought up, like, coloring books, digital coloring books, where you can only color in the lines. And I was like, well, that's really obvious. You just make all the people weird colors. And like that's where you find the joy in that. Mm-hmm. It's like I fully have confidence in kids to find weird chaos and joy given, no matter what they're given.
That's such a good point. Like, I don't think it'll ever, yeah, like, kids will not be constrained by technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. For better or worse.
Like, sure, we have so much technology now, but if you give a kid some slime,
yeah,
they're just, yeah, gonna have the best day.
Yeah.
Like, and that hasn't stopped since, like, the 90s of just, like, everybody being absolutely obsessed with this sort of weird stuff. So I'm not worried at all about children.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good point, but children are, like, especially, you know, at younger ages, are really sensory. So
yeah,
you might think that, like, oh, their minds are being warped by being given iPads, but ultimately I bet most children would still pick, like, the sensory toy over the iPad in certain situations. So
yeah. Yeah.
And actually, if, like, that iPad, talking about accessibility and stuff, if that iPad makes a coloring book accessible for a child who wouldn't usually be able to use one.
Yeah, I completely, like, agree.
Agree. That's a really good thing.
Great point, yeah.
But anyway, the future of all toys is Furbies.
Give me a good long Furby
A long Furby. Long Furbies. Everyone's going to have grotesque long Furbies. I go on Etsy and consider buying, like, $200-$300 long Furbies.
Yeah.
Every week I'm like, oh my god, I'm going to buy this.
I love them so much.
Plug your pluggables.
Quick housekeeping note, the next episode is going to be a little end of year Q&A episode as we take a break, reflect on the year, and also plan for some exciting stuff for the show in the new year. So yeah, keep an eye out for that.
You have 2 days to go to the Discord server and submit questions for the Q&A if you want to. We've already had people putting them in. So if you want to join our Discord server, then you can go to letslearneverythingpod.com. You can also find all of our other socials on there.
I would like to give a little shout out to Raphael_TM for their review. They say, so fun and informative.
Aww.
This podcast is so lovely, fun, informative, and funny. I just came across it a couple of days ago and love it. I'm looking forward to seeing the Wikipedia page on animals by number of bones.
It's ongoing.
I need more of this content, is what they say.
Thank you so much. So,
thank you for that. And then I'll just plug myself. I'm Tom Lum Person everywhere.
I'm caroline.roba.art on TikTok and Instagram, and carolinethebug everywhere else that matters.
I am big_science_energy on TikTok. I'm Ella Hubba on Twitter, and I'm none of your business anywhere else. Today has been a pretty heavy one in some respects. We have learnt about animal-human hybrids, chimeras, growing organs. We have learnt about the Judas goats and how they are used in a horrible way, but also a lot about conservation. And we have learnt about the history, the ancient history of toys and how children, they've always been there.
Turns out, yeah.
Shocker.
It's not a reason thing.
And next time, please join us where we're going to learn about everything. Well, good night!
Woo!
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubba, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
No, I think, can we do a, like a, all of us trying to make a long Furby? I'd watch that content of us trying to struggle.
Oh my god, we'll all make long Furbies.
How? Yeah.
We'll make?
But they get, they're made. What? You know, people on Etsy sell them, make them themselves.
I know.
On Etsy.
I know, but that's not where my head.
If we found one like tutorial and we all had to follow the same tutorial, just seeing what chaos came out at the other end of it would be perfect.